Good evening and welcome to another episode of Good Evening and Alfred Hitchcock Podcast. I am Chris Haig and I am joined as always by my two favourite Reginians. I'm really sorry if I mispronounce that, but I've never actually heard anyone say it out loud. Brandon Shea Matala and Tom Caldwell. How are we doing today, fellas?
Awesome.
It's pronounced hosers.
We're Canadian, eh?
I honestly don't know what that means, apart from a sort of a film that you said, oh, you're a hoser, eh? And I just was like...
A hoser. Sounds like somebody needs to watch Strange Brew.
The education, Chris, the education. I'm going to send you a toque in the mail.
Yep. A toque and some donuts.
Yeah.
So.
Fair enough.
So, excellent.
This is episode 24, and we are covering one of my personal favourite films. I'm so excited we finally made it here. It is The Man Who Knew Too Much of 1934. We are going to be having a kind of a synopsis from Tom, and we'll be having a nice discussion. But before that, Brandon is going to take us through the film with some notes he's prepared. So take it away, Brandon.
Yeah, you got it. I've got so many notes on this movie. We are getting into The Man Who Knew Too Much from 1934. So... Peter Lorre is the star of this, and it was released by Gaumont British. It was one of the most successful and critically acclaimed films of Hitchcock's British period. Now, everybody, buckle up, because I'm afraid I've got about 5 pages of notes on this one here. There's lots to talk about for this movie. Wikipedia lists the release date simply as December of 1934, and the film received its opening in the New York theaters on the 21st of March, 1935. Before switching to this project, Hitchcock was reported to be working on a film called Roadhouse, which was eventually directed by Maurice Elvey. The film started when Hitchcock and writer Charles Bennett tried to adapt a Bulldog Drummond story revolving around international conspiracies and the kidnapping of a baby. Its original title was going to be Bulldog Drummond's Baby. Bennett was able to draw upon his personal experiences working for the British Intelligence Service during the First World War. However, John Maxwell, who was the studio head, became increasingly concerned that Bulldog Drummond's Baby would be too costly to film, and the project was shelved. The deal for an adaptation fell through, and the frame of the plot was reused in the script for The Man Who Knew Too Much. The title itself was taken from a completely unrelated compilation of short stories by G.K. Chesterton. Now, the story for this film is credited to Bennett and D.B. Wyndham Lewis. Bennett claimed that Lewis had been hired to write some dialogue that was never used, but provided also none of the story. The Man Who Knew Too Much saw the first proper introduction of the MacGuffin, a storytelling device often attributed to MacPhail, which appears in many of Hitchcock's subsequent films. It's in the guise of a message about the planned assassination of a foreign dignitary in London. And so, in a nutshell, what the MacGuffin is it's an important piece of plot information for the movie, but honestly has absolutely no relevance to the viewer because it's simply designed to carry the plot forward. So in this case, it's the information about the assassination. Why are they trying to kill the guy? It doesn't matter. It doesn't really matter to any of us, right? So who cares what the MacGuffin actually is? It's just kind of a plot device. One of the most famous modern movies to use a MacGuffin is Pulp Fiction. When you like open up the briefcase, you never know what's inside of it. You just see this big shiny gold thing in there, but it's the thing that's kind of driving the plot of the movie. Along the way, several scenes were considered and discarded or altered for the final film. Some of these scenes include an opening sequence in St. Moritz, in which an ice skater traces a sequence of numbers on a skating rink and thus represents a secret code. There was a scene originally set in a barber shop, which was changed to the dentist after Mervyn LeRoy's film I Am a Fugitive from a Chain Gang had a similar scene in a barber shop. At one point during the script development, it was planned for the villains to hypnotize the mother and have her carry out the Albert Hall assassination while in a trance. And the shootout at the end of the film was based on the Sydney Street Siege, a real-life incident that took place in London's East End, where Hitchcock grew up, on the 3rd of January, 1911. The editor of the film, Hugh Stewart, later recalled that Hitchcock walked onto the set on the first day of shooting, banged down the script on a table, and announced another picture in the bag. Pretty arrogant to say that on the first day of shooting, but I thought that was kind of a neat little quote to include in
that's
the
his style.
Information. Hitchcock hired Australian composer Arthur Benjamin to write a piece of music, especially for the climactic scene at the Royal Albert Hall. The music, known as Storm Clown's Cantata, is used in both the 1934 version and the 1956 remake. You would think that with the ultimate critical and financial success of this film, that the release would have been made without any issues. However, the film was so unlike typical British films of the period that initially the Gaumont Board of Directors were unsure what to do with it. Seeking a second option, it was screened for distributor C.M. Wolfe, who had previously been highly critical of Hitchcock's early films, and he declared it as appalling rubbish. After Montague persuaded the board to give The Man Who Knew Too Much a chance, it was previewed for a week in London, where it garnered impressive reviews. Now, this film marked the first in a string of six consecutive thrillers directed by Hitchcock, many of them with a more pronounced political edge than had previously been seen in his films. Hitch's immediate circle of colleagues were socialists and anti-fascists, with Ivor Montague in particular a great admirer of Russian films. As early as 1941, while signed to Selznick, Hitchcock mooted remaking the film with a bigger budget, but it wouldn't be until he had secured a run of highly successful films for Paramount in the 50s that he would remake this film, this time in vibrant VistaVision with A-list stars James Stewart and Doris Day in the lead roles. Now, Alfred Hitchcock's cameo appears about 33 minutes into the film, and he can be seen crossing the street from right to left in a big black trench coat before Bob and Clive enter the chapel. Now, this is contested, though. Philip Kemp, in the commentary for The Man Who Knew Too Much on the Criterion release, says he actually doubts that that's Hitchcock, and we don't actually get a good view of his face. So it could be him, it could not be. When he pointed it out, I'm like, yeah, that kind of looks like Hitchcock's figure, so it could be him, it might not be. And if you want to look for it in particular, there's a bus that goes by that says the Isle of Man on the side of it, and it's right in the next cut that this person walks by the screen from right to left. And then at this point, I got to point out that I realize we forgot to mention the Hitchcock cameo in the film number 17. And it's during the final chase sequence, so I'll just say it now. There's a short sequence showing panicking passengers on the speeding bus. And while this is also contested, some claim that Hitchcock is in the passenger, is the passenger seen near the center of the frame, but it is a bit hard to tell. Okay, now it's for some of the actors in this film. Leslie Banks as Bob Lawrence joined Frank Benson's company and made his acting debut in October 1911 in the town hall of Brecon, playing Old Gobbo in The Merchant of Venice. He then toured the United States and Canada with Henry V. Esmond and Eva Moore in 1912 and 1913. He returned to London, and he appeared for the first time on the West End stage at the Vaudeville Theatre on the 5th of May 1914 as Lord Merton in The Dangerous Age. During the First World War, he served with the Essex Regiment. He received injuries that left his face partially scarred and paralyzed. In his acting career, he would use this injury to good effect by showing the unblemished side of his face while playing comedy or romance, and the scarred, paralyzed side of his face when playing drama or tragedy. After the war, Banks joined the Birmingham Repertory Theatre, and he returned to London in 1921 and established himself as a leading dramatic actor and West End star, known for his powerful yet restrained performances. Working in both London and New York City, he gained prominence on both sides of the Atlantic, and it was when he was in New York that Kenneth McGowan persuaded him to go to Hollywood and make a stage debut there in The Hounds of Zaroff in 1932. His formidable bulk and intimidating aspect served him well in his first important role as the diabolical Russian hunter of human prey in The Most Dangerous Game. And this is the film that I know him the most for. It's really, really good. The film features Joel McRae and Fay Wray. And for the rest of his career, he divided his time between Britain and the United States and between film and theater. We will see him again in Jamaica Inn. Edna Best, as Jill Lawrence, was known on the London stage before she entered films in 1921. Having made her debut at the Grand Theatre, Southampton, in Charlie's Aunt in 1917, she also won a silver swimming cup as the Lady Swimming Champion of Sussex. She is best remembered for her role in this film, but among her other film credits are Intermezzo, A Love Story from 1939, Swiss Family Robinson from 1940, and The Ghost and Mrs. Muir from 1947. Best received a nomination for an Emmy Award in 1957 for her role in the This Happy Breed, and this is her only Hitchcock appearance. Frank Vosper as Ramon Levine. Vosper made his stage debut in 1919 and was best known for playing urbane villains. His extensive stage experience, including appearing in his own play, Love from a Stranger, in 1936, which was adapted from the story Philomel Cottage by Agatha Christie. His screenplays include co-writing the comedy No Funny Business in 1933, and he also wrote People Like Us, which was based on the case of Edith Thompson and Frederick Bywaters. It was banned by the Lord Chamberlain after a performance at the Strand Theatre featuring Athol Fleming, and it remained unperformed until 1948 when it premiered at Wyndham's Theatre in London with Miles Mallison, George Rose, Robert Fleming, and Kathleen Michael. We also saw Frank Vosper as Prince Gustav in Waltzes from Vienna. And last we're going to talk about is Peter Lorre. So he played Abbott. Where to begin with this masterful actor of early sound cinema? He was born as Laszlo Lowenstein on the 26th of June, 1904, and died on March 23rd, 1964. He was an Austro-Hungarian-born actor. He began his stage career in Vienna before moving to Germany, where he worked first on stage, then in film in Berlin, in the late 20s and early 30s. Lorre caused an international sensation in the German film M from 1931, and that is an absolute masterpiece that everybody needs to see. It was directed by Fritz Lang, and he portrayed a serial killer who preys on little girls. Lorre left Germany when Adolf Hitler came to power. His first English-language film was The Man Who Knew Too Much, made in Great Britain. Apparently, Peter Lorre was unable to speak English at the time of filming, and he learned his lines phonetically. Lorre eventually settled in Hollywood, and he later became a featured player in many Hollywood crime and mystery films. In his initial American films, Mad Love and Crime and Punishment, he continued to play murderers, but he was then cast playing Mr. Motto, the Japanese detective in a run of B pictures. From 1941 to 1946, he mainly worked for Warner Brothers. His first film for them was The Maltese Falcon in 1941, which began a sequence in which he appeared with Humphrey Bogart and Sidney Greenstreet. This was followed by Casablanca in 1942, which was the second of nine films in which Lorre and Greenstreet appeared together. Some of Lorre's other films include Frank Capra's Arsenic and Old Lace in 1944 and Disney's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea in 1954. He was frequently typecast as a sinister foreigner. His later career was erratic. Lorre was the first actor to play a James Bond villain as Le Chiffre in the TV version of Casino Royale in 1954. Some of his last roles were in horror, with films directed by Roger Corman. Lorre was inducted into the Grand Order of Water Rats, the world's oldest theatrical fraternity, in 1942. And Lorre was honored with a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame at 6619 Hollywood Boulevard in February of 1960. Lorre's accent and large-eyed face became a favorite target of comedians and cartoonists. In particular, several Warner Brothers cartoons used a caricature of Lorre's face with an impression by Mel Blanc, including Hollywood Steps Out, Birth of a Notion, Hair-Raising Hair, and Racketeer Rabbit, among others. And then something interesting was actor Eugene Weingand, who was unrelated to Lorre, attempted in 1963 to trade on his slight resemblance of the actor by changing his name to Peter Lorre as L-O-R-I-E. But his petition was rejected by the courts, and after Lorre's death, however, he did refer to himself as Lorre's son, which is, that's pretty interesting. And we will see Lorre again in Secret Agent. And that's the extent of my notes for today. Thank you for your patience, everybody.
Good job. Thanks, man.
No, that's fantastic. So Tom is going to give us a quick synopsis of the film, and then we will lead right into the discussion.
A couple of British tourists traveling in Switzerland with their daughter. They witness the assassination of a Frenchman who, before he dies, tells them about a plot to murder a foreign diplomat in London. To ensure the couple's silence, the spy ring captures the little girl. The couple returns to London to track down the kidnappers, and the mother manages to save the ambassador's life just as he's about to be shot during a concert at Albert Hall. The picture winds up with the police smoking the spy gang out of their hiding place with the saving of a little girl. And that synopsis written by Sir Alfred Hitchcock. da, da, da. So it doesn't get much more authentic than that. Thank you, Alfred, for submitting that to the show. Yeah. We appreciate that.
Thanks, Al. Thanks, Al. We appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening, Alfred.
Yeah. Thanks for somewhat, Albert. But yeah, so I could talk a lot about this film, and I will, but I really wanted to see what you guys thought of it first. So, Brandon, do you want to kick us off?
I have seen this movie once before. It has been quite a while since I've seen it, but this movie is pretty darn amazing. I was really blown away with it, and one of the things that I really liked about the movie that I want to talk about right off the bat is just how concise it is. Mm-hmm. Like, it's really quick. You know, it is only 75 minutes long, but I really think that that adds a great deal to the film and makes it so compelling, because it's just kind of go, 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 really rapid. All the fat is cut out of this film. And, yeah, I really think that right off the bat, that's my initial impression and why I think a part of it is so amazing.
Yeah. Tom, what do you think?
I enjoyed the hell out of it. It's, again, a very modern, fast-moving film, like you said. It's interesting. It doesn't get boring. And it's really a good example of what Hitchcock can do and how good his films can be.
Yeah. No, I would agree. I mean, one of the things, because this was when I was getting into Hitchcock, this is one of the older canon that I looked at. So before I started, you know, the podcast and everything, I didn't know anything about the 20s films and not much about further back, but this was one of the ones I did check out. And okay, I've been in love with this film for years. And I think it's amazing. And I can watch it at any time, and it's fab. But no, I mean, the whole thing you were saying about being kind of quick, it's very well paced, and it's got almost kind of like an elegant simplicity to it, in that apart from the twist at the beginning when you find out, you know, who various people's allegiances are, it doesn't kind of try and tie you up with too many extra B plots or trying to extra, you know, bits and bats. I think that is one thing that happens a lot with kind of modern films. I love modern films, but, you know, most films now are 2 hours long.
Mm-hmm.
This was like, do you know what? We can make this a really tight 75 minutes, and it works, and it's much better, you know, for that. I really enjoy that. Just everything about it. It's basically like the template for how to make a really good, taut, tense thriller. The thing that always stands out to me, and you guys might see this, is that we actually have really likable, engaging characters. So, like, Jill, who's the mother, I basically think she's amazing. And she's such a fantastic heroine, because, you know, I love Hitchcock, but he's not the best at kind of giving women active support, kind of active roles within these films. But with this, she's the one who stops the plot at the Albert Hall. She's the one who, you know, saves her daughter in the end, because she's like a sharpshooter. You know, she's a skilled marksman. You know, she's just as active as a husband. And her husband is the one who ends up getting kidnapped, and, you know, there's that whole sequence where he's still doing stuff, but it's very much a kind of, he's a, you know, a dude in distress, not a damsel in distress. I just thought that was really enjoyable, and it was a nice change of pace. So, what else really worked for you guys with this? You mentioned the
wraparound with the mom shooting the villain at the end was a beautiful wraparound to what at the beginning of the film was her shooting Skeet. At which you see that at the beginning of the film, we think, oh, this is just filler, this is just some kind of background that's not really relevant, and then you realize, oh, that's why she was shooting a gun at the beginning of the film. So, yeah. You're right, it's an amazing, it's a really good, powerful role for her to solve the problems at the end.
It's a literal Chekhov's gun. You see her with the gun so that she can then use it at the end. You know?
You got it.
And she does, I watched it a few days ago, but a lot's happened in a few days. So I believe, because it's her versus their friend, who then turns out to be, what is his name? It's Louis Bernard. And she loses to him. And kind of at the end, she kind of gets that triumph, she gets that victory, but it's somewhat way more important. But no, I just thought as well it was gorgeously shot, and it's kind of it's almost a bit like a Bond location because it starts with that hotel in the Alps,
yeah,
and it's intrigue, and it's just it's very kind of effortlessly cool.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I wanted to talk about with this film is its running time, you know. And as I've like given it a little bit of time since I've seen it, I think my impression of number 17 has actually gone up a bit with like thought.
Yeah.
But I mean, like number 17 was only an hour.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, one of the things that I know that I think is kind of funny is like the Universal horror movies, like The Mummy, you know, like the first one's like, I think it's like 90 minutes, but most of the sequels to The Mummy are only like a 60 minute runtime. Yeah. You know, and one of the things that I think is really funny is the third Mummy movie is 60 minutes long, but the first 20 minutes is recap of the previous film, believe it or not. But, I wonder what has changed in this time when they're trying to get as many, you know, as many screenings of a film in as possible in a day by building these megaplexes and having these long films. I wonder what's changed in that films used to be a lot shorter. You know, and it's going to be interesting when we get to the remake of this, because the remake is a full 2 hours, which is 45 minutes longer than this, you know.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people out there, like, it's very divided. Like, half the people seem to think the original is better, half the people seem to think the remake is better. But, I mean, like, this is a really concise story with no fat, and that's what I really like about the movie. So yeah. I wanted to ask you guys what you thought about the running time first, because it's weird that it's 75 minutes, but it works so well.
Mm.
I wonder if in the day, too, if the theaters were so used to using, you know, they just played movies all day long. They played shorts, they played newsreels, and they just, you know. So maybe there wasn't such a tradition of doing a longer film. It was more like, you just, here's another 75-minute film in the midst of everything else that's happening. But
because Birth of a Nation is like a silent film, but it's like over 3 hours long, and it's a silent movie, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I can think of in terms of production values and everything, I can imagine it's a lot cheaper to make a much shorter film, cuts down on production costs and all that sort of thing, and it was still a kind of fledgling industry. But also, I think there wasn't as much leisure time back in the 20s, 30s, 40s, so they couldn't. They would have lost money having big 2 hour films. Where, you know, say if they've only got an hour, or like, oh, they've only got an hour and a half in the week, if there's a film that's 2 hours long, people aren't going to go if they don't have that time. So by making shorter, more accessible films, you're more likely to kind of get people who will just kind of sneak in, or kind of go, I tell you what, I'll sneak in a film this week. Or I'll sneak in, you know, or this or that.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
I think it works. I also think there's less, when I say less than three, it's not just in terms of like the kind of the production costs and all that sort of thing, but I think there wasn't as much material as they could talk about, because, you know, in 1930s we're talking in a kind of a post-Hays Code era where they could only talk about, you know, certain things, and so there's more restrictions on them, so there's less, there's more kind of ground that's easily trodden, so it's like, okay, we'll just make them a bit shorter then, you know, there's less for us to explore, there's less material.
See, that's interesting, because like Hitchcock would make use of that like running time of a movie, and and I think it prior to Psycho, people would just kind of come and go to movies. You would think that the length of a movie wouldn't matter. When he did release Psycho, there was that whole media campaign that it's like nobody is allowed in the theater after the film starts.
Yeah,
spoilers for Psycho. The reason was because, you know, Janet Leigh's character dies relatively early in the film.
Spoilers.
And so if somebody came in late, they would be like, where's her character, right? And so that was the reasoning behind it. But, I mean, up until then, people would just kind of come and go to theaters. At least that's the impression that I have. So running time shouldn't matter.
Well, that was the tradition in the day that they talk about. Like, a theater was just an ongoing stream of films, and you just sort of walked in and out. The tradition of going to the start of a film to see a specific film at a specific time hadn't developed yet. So you're right, like, that's why he promoted, and, you know, the master of promotion too, like, he wanted to create hype and make it exciting and dangerous to go to see Psycho, and you had to be there early. Plus, it was just rude to come in late, right? He wanted people to pay respect to the film and be there and pay attention. But yeah, no, it is. I think the running time of this film is perfect, and it works really well.
Yeah, it also makes it really accessible. in terms of, like, if you know, oh, we'll just do a quick one as well. Anyway, go on, sorry. Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I found interesting about the film was the comedy aspect of it. There was some comedy that really worked in this film, but, I mean, like, I didn't really like the comedy banter between the husband and the wife, because it kind of felt forced to me. But there was some stuff in this that was truly, truly funny. Like the scene where he gets his friend to go into the dentist, mm-hmm. right? I thought that was great. When they go into that sun worship church and he's like trying to convey information by singing, like that was absolutely brilliant. We've got these regular people, like that mailman who's like in the middle of the street fight. The cops are trying to put him aside. He's like, I got to deliver my mail. And he's like, I don't care that there's a gunfight going on. I got my job to do, you know? So like there's some really, really great comedy that fits well into the film that I think Hitchcock, you know, this is the start of it, and it starts to be a part of his films going forward. But that interaction between the husband and the wife and that weird banter didn't quite work for me at the beginning of the film. So what do you guys think about the comedy in it?
I love the dentist's office scene and the fighting to put the gas mask on each other and that clever way where he replaced the dentist and posed. He posed as the bad guy and kind of mumbles and learns everything that they're talking about in the background and deceives them. That was a wonderfully funny scene. And I digressed a little bit. I'd take a tangent, but it totally made me think of Steve Martin in Little Shop of Horrors. So that's my recommended follow-up film for any viewers that are interested.
Yeah. This is a loose yeah. sequel to the
If you like much. Comedy and dental hygiene, then definitely check that out. Yeah, I love the bit because they go to the sun cult in the church. Where the bad guys are operating out of, and it is this just really funny, like trying to sing the plot points while it's in a thing. It's just, you know, it's really funny. I didn't mind the banter between the husband and wife, because there's that opening bit where, you know, she fudges the shot effectively because of the daughter, and she teases her a bit and jokes with the husband a bit and jokes with Louis a bit, and it reminds me a bit of like the Thin Man films, where there's that kind of screwball comedy banter, and I was like, that's fine, I don't really mind it. The only part that stuck out to me, and it's something that's become less annoying the more I've watched it, is the character of Betty, because the first time I watched it, she just annoyed me. I think it was because there was a lot of, you know, like, oh daddy, kind of crying kind of stuff, which is understandable, but it's just, there's that issue people have with kids in kind of action films and horror films. It's like, should they be there? You know, if you're not going to use them well and all that sort of thing. But it's fine. The more I've watched it, it's gone on absolutely fine.
I really liked her acting myself, like, yeah. Especially when they showed her on that sleigh, you know, and her facial reaction. Like, that was really, I don't know, I thought her acting was really well in that, really well done in that scene.
Yeah. No, that's fair, and I agree with it. It was just the first time I watched it, it was kind of that initial, it's like at the end of the film where she's reunited and she's very kind of crying and trembling, all that sort of thing. I remember watching it and feeling a bit like, oh, for God's sake, everyone's dead, it's fine, just pull yourself together. But no, it is, you know, the entire cast is great. I mean, I could talk for quite a while about how great Peter Lorre is in this film.
Well, kind start of it. How, talk about Lorre. Go right ahead.
Yeah, he's so good.
He is.
He's this magnetic presence, you know, and you mentioned M, which is a fantastic film he's in, but I've also seen him in Arslick and Old Lace, and he's really funny in that as a kind of assistant to the bad guy, and he's just, you know, for a guy who doesn't speak English really well, and a lot of his stuff was phonetic, he told so much with his facial expressions. So there's the bit where, you know, it's the shootout, it's the finale, and I honestly can't remember a name at the moment, but his like female assistant, his like loving lover, she gets shot and she dies in his arms, and it's this little moment of just everything goes on in his face, and I it's incredible for a guy who, you know, didn't come from an English-speaking background, to have such an amazing performance in an English-speaking film was fantastic. But yeah, all the performances were really great. I really liked, you know, I'm trying, Edna Best as Jill. I thought she was ace. I thought she was a great, you know, Hitchcock heroine. Leslie Banks was great. You know, Nova Pilbeam, who played Betty, and just, you know, all these... It was just a solid, enjoyable cast and kind of put into this kind of fantastic thriller.
Tom, do you have any thoughts on Peter Lorre?
A brilliant character. Like, he you know, it just really made the film, and he is sort of Phantom of the Opera a little bit, you know? But yeah. He comes in and... just makes the film happen, and he kind of has, like, he has that funny look to him, right? That kind of makes him the a wonderful villain. And no, I thought his character was really good.
The scene that I really liked the best, it was a small one, was when he offers the dad the cigarettes, and the guy's like, "Are these poisoned?" And just the laugh that Peter Lorre has felt really genuine in the acting moment. Like, yeah, I'm going to poison you. After all this, I'm going to poison you with a cigarette, right? You know, like, is it? I thought that was really, really neat and really well done there. But, he's a really emotive actor. Like, he's got this very unique face, but he can emote a lot with that face. And he was really well used in this. And, I mean, I couldn't picture this movie without him. No. So I don't know I don't remember who the bad guy is in the sequel, or sorry, the remake. But you know, I'm gonna be interested to see how well they follow up for this type of character.
Well, that's the thing that'll be interesting, because it's one of the only times where a director has decided to remake their own work,
right?
And so it will be, you know. And I know I've not seen the 56 one recently, but from what I remember, the plot is it's similar-ish, but not a direct remake. Mm-hmm. So it'll be really interesting to sort of see how they compare. But yeah, you know, Peter Lorre, he literally is the face on the poster for this film. You know, he's such a fantastic villain. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you see him in M, if you see him in kind of Maltese Falcon and all that kind of stuff, you know, bless him, I'm sure he was a lovely, lovely guy, but he has got a face that's perfect for a screen villain.
Yeah.
You know, particularly back in the, you know, 30s and 40s, where if you didn't look like a kind of matinee idol, or, you know, kind of like, I'm trying to remember his name, Clark Gable, you know, you were kind of a bit more villainous. So, yeah, he anchors the film, and it's just, from the moment he's introduced, he kind of chews the scenery at every opportunity. And so even his death, because he gets shot from behind a door, and he just kind of, it's such a great way to go out, because he does it with this almost like sardonic smile on his face. So yeah, I think he's absolutely fantastic in it.
See, my impression on that death is that's supposed to be a suicide at the end. Like, I know that
like
the gun's
suicide
not
by
pointed.
Yeah.
Not suicide by cop, but like that he actually did shoot himself because he was behind the door, right?
Oh,
like the gun wasn't really pointed at him, so like when they pull it out, it doesn't quite work. But my impression was that it was supposed to be that he shot himself. Am I wrong on that?
Oh no, I thought it was that he
got shot through the door.
Well, that he kind of fired through the door, so they'd fire back, and it'd be like a suicide by cop sort of thing. That's what I thought it was. That's what I thought it was. But it's an interesting take on it, to be fair, because it's like, you know, he's, you know, lost his gang and everything's gone wrong and the assassination attempt has failed. And so, yeah, I could definitely understand that. I love the set pieces in this film. I think this is one of the first Hitchcock films where it's almost kind of evident, right, okay, this is, you know, the Alps set piece. This is the Albert Hall set piece. This is the church set piece. And they just really work well together. So what did you guys think of, like, the action in this film?
I think that Albert Hall was it's a beautiful set of scenes, and it's not a cliche, but it's a real standard scenario where there's a big concert happening, and it's kind of like the Lincoln assassination, right, historically. And I really enjoyed the Albert Hall sequence and the musical parts of that.
Well, the addition of the Albert Hall is going to be something that we're going to see a lot as one of those Hitchcock tropes, where he has these grand landmarks, and he focuses a story around a landmark, like, you know, like Rushmore and North by Northwest. The Statue of Liberty, I think, is from Secret Agent, but I'm not 100% certain on that right now. We had that museum in geez, I'm getting all confused now. Was it murder or blackmail? I think it was blackmail, actually, where, you know, we had that museum with that, you know, all these interesting large landmarks. And he almost focuses. He's like, look, I want to make a movie, and we're going to have the climax at this landmark. Now write me a movie that involves this, you know. And it's interesting because it makes it for really unique visual storytelling. And it enhances the scope of the film by having these massive monuments, you know. And mountains in the Alps is also a reoccurring theme of his. Like, we're going to, like, the opening of this reminds me a lot of the opening of The Lady Vanishes, which we'll get to in a few films. You know, this Swiss Alp, this mountainous environment, this, you know, kind of snowed in area or whatever. But these are reoccurring things that he uses over and over again in his films. And it's, while The Man Who Knew Too Much is the only Hitchcock film that had a remake, like, almost all of Hitchcock's films are basically shuffling of different ideas that he just consistently uses over and over. Like, even in this one here, we've almost got the introduction of the average person getting swept up in these grand affairs, which is also a reoccurring theme that'll happen throughout his films, you know, and it's really brought to fruition here as a first major example of it. These regular people, their kid has been kidnapped, and they're involved in these events while they were on holiday.
You know, and getting back to a bit of your point there, too, it's smart filmmaking where he's taking advantage of the history of Albert Hall, and right away people recognize what it is, and he doesn't have to build that or explain it to you or tell you what it is. And it's recognizable and it's familiar, like the Statue of Liberty, like Mount Rushmore, like the museums, and we feel comfortable being there. We know what it means. We can just move on with the film. We don't have to have a lot of exposition as to explaining why we're there, what it is.
Yeah, exactly. It's efficient kind of shorthand. You can go, right, okay, you know this cultural landmark, you know this cultural landmark, right, we're going to go there, and we're just going to move everything there, and it'll just make sense. But no, I also agree with Brandon in the sense of it's here that you really start to see these big themes or big tropes that he uses kind of manifest a bit. So it's the ordinary person getting swept up in a situation. It's the use of, you know, kind of landmarks as set pieces or backdrops to these big kind of climactic moments. You know, a spy thriller plot or, you know, kind of deception and lots of all those big things that kind of do become big touchstones of what, you know, what makes an Alfred Hitchcock film. Well, it usually has these in it, yeah. That kind of thing. But not me. Do you guys have any final thoughts on the film before we wrap up?
Well, I've actually got a few more things that I want to talk about here.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah. One of the most amazing sequences in this whole film for me was the dinner sequence when that guy gets shot, right? Because the symbology of that, tying that string from that knitting to the guy's jacket and having it unravel, you know, it's like the symbology of this. Okay, so this is, the plot is unraveling. The plot is being drawn out and about. This guy is entangling all these people in his web of events, right? And then it leads to the climax of his life is being hung on by a thread. And as soon as he cuts that string off of his banquet jacket, he gets shot and dies. So his life is being hung by a thread. When he cuts that thread, he dies. Like, this is just one of the most amazing visual sequences. Like, I think this is the best thing we've seen yet from Hitchcock, is this one little scene, and it blew me away. You know, we've got this wonderful room with these large windows looking at the mountain. Like, wow, this is just absolutely stunning, amazing filmmaking.
So you liked it.
I loved it. I love cool. it. I can't stress enough.
No, right on. And that's great. Isn't it? It's cool to be so passionate about a piece of work, right?
Yeah.
I mean, particularly because there's been, you know, I think we can be honest, there's been times in the past few months where we've been like, okay, so this film is a thing.
This is a thing that happened.
Yeah. This was an hour or so that I don't ever think I'll get back, but that's fine. Mm-hmm. But no, this is why I love doing this. Particularly, you know, this is a film I love. I never picked up on that, on the thing. I thought, oh, it's like unraveling, as in the truth is unraveling or the lies unraveling. I didn't even think of it because it's a bit like Clothos in Greek mythology. You know, the I can't remember what the thing is, but they're basically the ones who snip the thread of life, and once that's snipped, they die. Mm. And I never even thought of that, so I love that kind of symbolism that goes into it. And yeah, no, it's just so good.
Yeah.
I could easily just cover this again in the future thing, just being like, this one's crap, should just watch Man Who Knew Too Much again.
If you guys don't have the Criterion edition, you know, go to the library, borrow it if you don't want to buy it, check it out. There's lots of really interesting bonus features. There's a really good interview with Guillermo del Toro in it. And, you know, Guillermo del Toro is a huge Hitchcock fan. He's actually written a book on Hitchcock, and he talks about it. And he talks about how this is, like, basically the most important Hitchcock film there is, because this is the Hitchcock that we know from now on. You know, he has a couple of tangents here and there, but in a nutshell, this defines the rest of this man's career. And he's found his niche, and he's like, how can I play with this niche? How can I take these elements and just play with them? And that's what he does for the remaining, 40 films or, you know, 35 films, whatever's left in his career. And it's a marvelous shift, and it's an amazing shift. And honestly, it is truly mind-boggling that he was able to get this film done after the failure of the last couple of films that he had, you know?
Maybe so that's why it was such a short production, too.
It could possibly be. But, I mean, just imagine, I bet you, had he done one more melodrama, one more, you know, love piece, or one more weird little film, and instead of this could have been the end of Hitchcock's career. You know, like, this is pivotal. This is the most important picture in Hitchcock's entire filmography, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Right on.
Yeah, so, absolutely. I mean,
and I guess those would be my final thoughts, yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say, sorry, go on.
I'm sure I'm going to get emails from you guys for the rest of the day about this film, I'm sure.
Yeah. Oh, there'll definitely be talking going on in the little group chat we have. But no, so I didn't even know about the Del Toro books. I'm definitely checking that out. Definitely, because I ended up getting this on one of those, you know, the DVDs where there's three films on it?
Yeah.
So I got this. There's a random Sherlock Holmes one on it, and there's also Young and Innocent, which we'll be covering in the next few episodes. But yeah, this film is kind of, you can't recommend it highly enough. And it is true what Brandon says, in the sense of, it is such an important film, because we could have ended up with, you know, Hitchcock just being someone who, oh, kind of lost the annals of time, really. And this is the big... this is the big thing that suddenly made the jump from small-time director to Alfred Hitchcock, to auteur, so...
Final thoughts, Tom?
This is a great podcast. You guys are really smart.
Oh, no,
I'm enjoying listening to this. It was an amazing film. Really enjoyed it. And yeah, you're right. It really sets a benchmark for what Hitchcock can do. And I say this all the time, but these are timeless films. Like, this film is as interesting today as it ever was. Highly recommended. Required viewing. Go out and get a copy and look it up and watch this film for sure.
Okay, so ratings for the film?
I would give it 4 to 5 gas masks at the dentist chair.
Excellent. I'm going to give it, yeah, definitely, I'm going to give it 4 hymns at the sun worshippers.
Ah, see, I like that. This is one of my favorites, so I'm going to have to give it 5 screams in the Albert Hall.
Okay, let's hear them.
I love this.
Right on.
I can't scream. I can't. My voice is that relatively low. I can't actually scream anymore. So,
yeah. That's funny.
Yeah.
Excellent. So for coming up on Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast, we have got a special thing coming out for you that's going to be released on Christmas Day. We don't want to tell you what it is. It's already recorded it. We actually recorded it before we recorded this one, because I was so eager to get to it, because it was such a fun idea. So we had that one coming up for you. Next month's episode is going to be great, because we've got 2 wonderful guests joining us. So we'll be covering the 39 steps, and we're going to have Alice Baker, who loyal listeners of the show may remember. She was one of our podcast pals way back on episode 2, and she had let us know that 39 steps was her favorite. So now that we finally got there, we've invited her on. And as long as we can get everybody's schedules to work, then as well is David Cairns, who joined us when we talked about blackmail, I think it was. Was it blackmail or murder? I get confused on my one word titles.
I don't remember. Yeah.
I think it was blackmail, actually. It was the first sound picture, which I think is blackmail. So I'm a terrible Hitchcock person, and I'm about to be fired from this show. But that's the next episode. And then we were tentatively working as well for Secret Agent to have a special guest on for that one as well. But I'll keep that one under wraps. But, you know, this is exciting. We're in the good stuff here. And I want to start doing this podcast weekly. Let's do it.
No.
No, okay. No, we'll keep it.
I have other stuff to do.
Excellent.
Brandon, you really should try and do a couple more podcasts, I think.
Yeah.
I should. Try and get a few more in there. We would like to thank very much the Fandom Podcast Network for hosting. We're available in their feed as well as our own independent feed. You know, it'd be a really big help if you guys could give us a rating or a review in Apple Podcasts. Share the show, retweet some of the links. It just helps us to get us out there. I think that we're going to start to grow now that we're in his good works here. You know, because I've talked with Tom Elliott of the Twilight Zone podcast, and he says, well, he listens along because the movies aren't so good. He hasn't really been watching along, but he's still been enjoying the discussions. But now that we're at the good stuff, I think we're going to get a lot more people invested in the show and a lot more interest in the show. So I'm very excited. I'm glad that we've taken this long build up to get to here. So thanks very much to the Fandom Podcast Network for hosting us, as well as our own independent feed. Thank you so much to our good friend Jason Cullimore for creating our awesome theme. You can find him and his work at jasoncullimore.com. And then please be sure to check out our friends Annie and Catherine over on their podcast, Good Evening, and Alfred Hitchcock Presents podcast. And Annie and Catherine are going through all of the Hitchcock episodes of that show, kind of in a random order. But it's a lot of fun. I'm following along with them. It's great. It's definitely my go-to podcast on Wednesdays when it drops. So definitely check it out. With our two podcasts combined, you get a near comprehensive look at the Grandmaster's works. And you can find me on Twitter at Brandon Metella. You can find me over on Trek FM with Melodic Treks and Warp 5. Melodic Treks is about the music of Star Trek. Warp 5 is all about Star Trek Enterprise. And I host an intermittent podcast on the Cinematic Sound Radio Network called Breaking the Waves. And I'm working on episode 3, that episode with Hannibal music that I promised. I'm working on it right now. It's just been a zoo. So, Tom, where can people find you when you're not dropping your dog on the middle of the ski Alps, almost killing somebody who's barreling down the mountain?
That would be fun. The Tom Caldwell on Instagram and TomCaldwell3000 on Twitter. Thank you for everybody that follows us, and we appreciate all the listeners and all the interaction with everybody.
Excellent. And Chris, where can people find you when you're not worshiping the sun?
When I'm not busy shooting people off rooftops to save my daughter, you can find me on Twitter at @Hyatt_boy. I talk about kind of like politics and neuroscience and pop music and kind of what books I'm reading and just kind of silly, fun stuff, so please check me out there. I also co-host a show called North by Nerd West with my best mate Emma Platt. We've taken a bit of a hiatus just while we both catch up on real life stuff, but hopefully we'll be able to get some new episodes out either in the next couple of months or in the new year, so definitely check those out.
Thank you.
Excellent.
No, thank you. So I think that is about it. Thank you so much for checking us out. I can't believe we've actually made it all the way to episode 24. That is huge. But I think all that's left to say is good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.